And as I always start this off every year, our second year, so it'd be 21 years ago.
Ready to go. Okay, good.
On Tuesday night, we had Hal Lindsey speak.
I think we're not.
And he gave a presentation. And then most of his session ended up being question and answer about current events. And so we started Tuesday nights as current events.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Night dealing with the application of our prophecy. Because as futurists, we believe that things are related to what's happening in Bible prophecy. And this conference, of course, is focused on current events more than most. But we're still going to have our current events thing. And our first speaker is going to be Bill Koenig, who's a White House correspondent. And he's going to been hanging out at the White House for, 15 years?
14
years. And he knows a lot about what's going on in Washington, D.C., and politically and with Israel. And so I'll let Bill start.
Thank you, Tommy. Appreciate it. Thank you for being here this evening. And this has been a great conference as usual. And also, it always seems to be so timely. And much has been happening lately. And as we watch Bible prophecy continue to unfold, and unfold at just an amazing pace, it just keeps building and building. And that's what I'm going to attempt to do tonight is connect some dots. And it is getting more and more challenging to do that. But I'm going to try to give you an overall summary of what's taking place right now, some of the things we can watch going into 2015. To start with, this is a copy of our website address, watch.org. We are in the next couple of days, we're going to have a brand new, up-to-date website that's also going to be excellent on smartphones and tablets. So we hope to have that out by Friday. And it's going to be very, very user-friendly, and we're real excited about it. So hopefully by Friday we'll have that ready, good to go. This is what we send out every Friday. We have a weekly news report that's a summary of the news that happened that week that was biblically and prophetically relevant. It comes out every Friday, and it's certainly difficult to keep it to 18 to 20 pages every week, but that's just how much is going on and taking place right now. So, we're living, the way we look at it, it's an important read in the next 12 months. All major areas in prophecy are in play. We really have crossed the tipping point. Things are continuing to build, and it's not going to slow up and go in the other direction. It just keeps building. It's a tsunami that's building in many different areas. Unprecedented record-setting events in so many areas. The last few years I've been mentioning here, actually the last probably 3 years now. We used to have two or three major events taking place at the same time, but today, it might be two or three that are taking place and exciting, but today all 12 final day markers are in play. And that is a challenge to keep up with that, but also those 12 markers are all doing very unique things. Russia, world religion, EU, what they're doing, what Iran's doing, this Shiite versus Sunni conflict, one world political order, one world religious order. I'll get into that tonight. And what's taking place with Israel, God's time clock, and just the whole region. So that's just a few of the 12 that are taking place right now. And it's also important to be prepared personally. We attempt to do that to keep our readers informed of what's taking place. It's important. And that's the purpose of Bible prophecy. Let everybody know that we are quickly moving toward a time when we very likely will see our Messiah return for us. So that means sharing the gospel with family and friends and personal preparation and just being ready for His return. It's so important. And also know what to pray about. We have seen over and over again how prayer really does make a difference. And never lose sight of that. My wife spends a few hours every day praying, and she continues to pray about things, and along with her and some friends, and we see things happen in various places, politically, spiritually, and otherwise. And God answers prayers, and we can pray for our leaders. God has a defined plan for all of them, but prayer works and prayer for our leaders work. And we are obligated to pray for our leaders. Our subscription is $1 a week on a 12-month subscription, $1.15 a week on a 6-month subscription. And this is a copy of my book, Eye to Eye. Major consequences happen when we put pressure on Israel to divide their covenant land. I've documented over $90 billion events since the Madrid conference began in 1991, when the perfect storm was sending 30-foot waves into President Bush's home in Kennebunkport, Maine. And based on Katrina, 9/11, I mean, all these major record-setting events corresponded at the time we were applying pressure in Israel to divide the land. And the greater the pressure in Israel, the greater the corresponding catastrophe. And we're going to start seeing how that's going to happen to the EU. The EU is determined to pressure Israel, and EU has a history. I could do a book on the EU. I could do a book on Tony Blair when he was the Prime Minister of the UK, and since he has been the quartet leader, it's going to happen to the EU. It's going to become a very difficult time for them. As a matter of fact, and I'll get into a little bit more detail, today the news is out that Al-Qaeda is going to focus on taking European jets out of the sky in a short period of time. It's got the European Union very focused. So what was the main news this week? The European Parliament was talking about voting on the Palestinian state. They were supposed to vote on November 26th. They moved it to the mid part of December. They had the debate on the 25th. They were going to vote on the 26th. They decided to move it to the mid December. And the other major news right now that has the Europeans concerned is Al-Qaeda attempting to take European jets out of the sky. You know, it's a mystery. Sometimes you see these events and the tragedies of these events take place, it's hard to comprehend, but this happens over and over again, and we have experienced the largest events in U.S. history when we are applying pressure in Israel. And then once again, the greater the pressure in Israel, the greater the corresponding catastrophe. And that covenant land that God gave to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob for an everlasting covenant, no earthly leader has the right to determine the boundaries of the promised land. And there will continue to be consequences of those that attempt to. I'm going to focus on four areas. Obama in the Middle East and their efforts, for the lack of a better word. Israel under pressure right now to make peace with the Palestinians. Well, is that Fatah? Is that Hamas? Who do they make peace with? And the Shiite versus Sunni conflict. This is big news. We have opposing caliphates. The Shiite-backed Iranian caliphate, the plan to control the Middle East, and then the Sunni Islamic State, Sunni caliphate, to attempt to control the Middle East. And then we've got the Turkey component to that as well. The leader of Turkey would like to be the leader of that caliphate as well. So it's going to be an interesting year in 2015, to say the least. And then also one world religion. The Pope is working overtime on attempting to unify Protestants and evangelicals with the Catholic Church. I'll go into some details on that. And also, he was at a mosque a couple of days ago in Istanbul praying with the Grand Mufti of Ankara. So, lots taking place. So, we'll get going here. Ezekiel 38-39, things are aligning. Isaiah 13-19 is aligning. Jeremiah 49, Elam, Persia, Iran is coming together. And Daniel 9-27, an eventual covenant. And then the nations of Psalm 83. I know there's debate on whether that's a prophetic scripture or not, but I think the nations of Psalm 83 are ones that we're watching. It's the neighborhood conflict with Israel. But anyhow, these are some of the key scriptures connecting the dots of bombing the Middle East. Three reasons why America's foreign policy is in danger. I had to get one where they're all smiling. Don't you feel comfortable when you go to bed at night? The reason we feel comfortable is because the God of Israel is still on the throne, not because of these guys. Obama in Israel, and even before his trip, in 2012 at the White House in March, he stated, told Israel that he has their back.
Is he stabbing Netanyahu in the back?
Tommy, you were actually early.
Okay, it only took
eight minutes.
Eight minutes all it took.
I can't do a presentation without my assistant. In Denver, right at the end of my message, he came up with some news that was in my next slide. But Tommy wanted to make sure that slide was there.
That was Colorado Springs.
Excuse me. I'm going to bring up the LaHaye Ice Center again from last year. Remember that? The LaHaye Ice Center at Liberty University? LaHaye Ice was actually an ice center, not a tunnel ice. That was pretty good. Tim liked it, too. Anyhow, I can go now. He's got it in there. So anyhow, when you look at Have Your Back, you have to look at who he selects. Secretary of Defense was Hagel. Secretary of State was Kerry. Susan Rice was National Security Advisor. And Samantha Powers is his UN Ambassador. And John Brennan, the CIA Director, is a Arab Republican. So that, when you look at, he's got Israel's back, who has he chosen to represent him in key areas of the world that will affect Israel? That speaks volumes. A couple months ago now, John Kerry had what I call an eye-to-eye week. Everything he touched just kind of went haywire. John has this messianic complex. To be quite honest, he believes that the reason there hasn't been peace in the last 20 years is because he was not Secretary of State. And he really believes this. And I've never seen an individual able to bring the rightest journalists, the journalists from the right and the journalists from the left, to agree to anything. But they agree that John Kerry is not up to the task. But for John, with having the kind of ego he has, he's determined to prove everybody wrong, so he tries harder and only makes things worse. But isn't that amazing? This is at a very crucial period of time for the United States and the international community in the Middle East. John Kerry's been selected to be the Secretary of State. He encouraged, behind the scenes, the European boycott of goods that were made in the settlement communities. He is the one that said when Israel and the Palestinians were having a difficult time earlier this year that if Israel didn't make peace with the Palestinians, there was a good chance of a third intifada. He planted the seed, as far as I'm concerned. And that's an irresponsible statement by our representative. He told Israel that you risk further isolation and delegitimization if you don't make peace with the Palestinians. And what was happening is the negotiations were taking place between the United States and Israel, not Israel and the Palestinians. And the Palestinians knew that. They'd already turned down a great offer in 2000 from Ehud Barak. Yasser Arafat did, and then in 2008 they turned down a very, very attractive deal, even more attractive than giving up most of Judea and Samaria and East Jerusalem, when he had over gave Abbas almost everything he wanted. But people forget that. They don't focus on that. They just keep trying to push and push and push and try to force something. And for him to say isolation, delegitimization, that's another impetus for the European community to push harder, because they're the ones that the BDS movement down here, that's headquartered out of the UK. That's a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Popping back up into the European boycott, the World Council of Churches down in Geneva, Switzerland, that supposedly represents a half billion Christians from 322 religious organizations around the world, they have also told the EU you need to be boycotting Israeli goods made in the settlement communities. So this is damage. And, you know, in a lot of ways, we laugh at his efforts, but at the same time, it's pretty serious, too. I laugh because he keeps trying to make, you know, it's like John Kerry was away for 10 years on another planet, and he came back and said, hey, I'm going to go come up with all these ideas, and he's using plans that have failed before. And it's causing a lot of problems, and what it's doing is causing more and more pressure to be exerted on Israel. Boaz Basmuni said, only the Obama administration would organize a summit to nine of the relevant players, which are Egypt, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Palestinian Authority. When there was a conflict between Hamas and Israel, the Egyptians came up with a ceasefire agreement that everybody agreed to, the Arab League, everybody agreed to, throughout the Middle East, the West, and the U.S., but Hamas wouldn't agree to it. It was a ridiculous. Everybody agreed to it but Hamas. So John Kerry goes to Paris. He brings Turkey in and Qatar that fund Hamas. They come up with a new agreement, and it's presented to Israel, and it looked like Hamas wrote the agreement. And it was a complete insult to Israel. I mean, everybody agreed to the ceasefire agreement, but no, let's go ahead and bring Turkey and Qatar in and let them write something that's totally favorable to Hamas. That's just irresponsibility. But that's what happened. Mike Warren, who was a very diplomatic ambassador to the U.S. for Israel, said Kerry wasn't invited and he shouldn't be coming. He cited Kerry's long history of unsuccessful diplomacy in the region. He said Kerry and the Obama administration have close ties with Qatar and Turkey, who are not on the best terms with Egypt right now, or other countries, especially since they're funders of Hamas. Israeli government source, Secretary of State John Kerry is completely capitulating to the demands of Hamas and his champion Qatar in drafting the Gaza War ceasefire proposal. And then down here, Kerry dug a tunnel under the Egyptian ceasefire proposal, which Israel accepted and Hamas rejected last week. He accepted most of the demands raised by Hamas. John Kerry's not eye weak. And then to put this in perspective, he went to Egypt to meet. And when he was in Cairo, he was on TV in the Israeli rejection, but it was marked by technical mishaps that either blotted out Kerry's face or distorted his voice. Before that, it was Egyptian security authorities who insisted on humiliating Kerry by carrying out a physical security check before his meeting with President Sisi. This is the lack of respect, and this is what's hurting us in the Middle East. And he said, before that, it was Kerry's unfortunate. So how is your day? Query to the grieving American mother of fallen IDF soldier Max Steinberg. And at Haaretz, this is a left-leaning newspaper. You can learn a lot from reading Haaretz, but they are so pro-Palestinian. I mean, they are so pro-giving up land unilaterally for Israel. It just sometimes makes your blood boil when you read the articles. You can learn the facts, but they are so far to the left. But even then, they said the Secretary of State has fallen prey to an ongoing series of mishaps, faux pas, and other unfortunate events, begging the critical question, has he become a nebbish? Faux pas, an embarrassing or tactless act or remark in a social situation. And a nebbish definition is a person, especially a man, who is regarded as pitifully ineffectual, timid, or submissive. This is the left-leaning Haaretz newspaper. This is not from the right, this is from the left. Again, at a very crucial time for the United States to have an effective Secretary of State. Obama writes Khomeini. This came out just recently that he had been writing Khomeini. In mid-October, President Obama secretly wrote to Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah al-Khomeini in the middle of last month and described it as a shared interest in fighting Islamic militants in Iraq and Syria, according to people briefing the correspondence. The letter appeared aimed both at buttressing the campaign against Islamic State and nudging Iran's religious leader closer to a nuclear deal. We are at an amazing time because the Islamic State is a very, very serious threat. And they need to be dealt with. And Iran, I mean, can you imagine the United States fighting alongside Iran working with Iran to take out the Islamic State, which will allow the Syrian President Assad to stay in position and to empower Hezbollah. This is the Middle East. But the think tanks in Washington, D.C. and other places are saying it is important for the United States to work with Iran in order to take out this radical thuggery of the Islamic State. So we can't side with the Islamic State, but we have one of our other major threats in the Middle East is Iran and their caliphate plans. But I'll get into that in a brief. But anyhow, Obama has had a good relationship with the Turkish President Erdogan. He was a prime minister, and they changed the constitution. He's an Islamist at, from the core. When he was elected, I think it was 2004, the first time, he got rid of 100 key generals with the Turkish military. And Turkey, for 20-plus years, had a very good relationship with Israel. They did a lot of military, joint military maneuvers together. They had a great working relationship. And from my friends in the Israeli government, they have been very concerned about how fast this wonderful relationship with the, Turkey has diminished. And it's a great concern. And Erdogan, for quite a few years, was considered Obama's best friend in the Middle East. And matter of fact, just a little over 90 days after he took office, he gave a speech to the Turkish parliament. This is the speech that he spoke of, where he said that the United States was not a Christian nation. And this is also the place where he said that there are moderate Muslims in the Middle East. And Erdogan rebuked him the next day, says there's no such thing as a moderate Muslim. And Erdogan's becoming more radical every day. And then they had a meeting, May 16, 2013, and I've been in a lot of Rose Garden events, and I've never had a picture quite like this. This was kind of interesting, to say the least. Well, all of a sudden they started talking about the Middle East and about Israel, and it just started raining. So this is on the front page of most internet sites around the world. Quite interesting, to say the least. But Erdogan says, just the other day, says that Muslims found the U.S. before Columbus. 3 centuries before Christopher Columbus were here, the Muslims were here. He said a lot of other things at that time, and in the last couple of weeks, you're beginning to really get a little bit concerned. And there hasn't been a lot of cooperation with Turkey to deal with the Islamic State because he doesn't like Assad, and a lot of people don't realize it. The problems in Syria began when Turkey kept... See, Turkey is like the OPEC of water for the Middle East. They have an enormous amount of water. But when they kept keeping water from Syria, it led into a very serious civil war type situation. And it was one of the most, if not the main catalyst that started this conflict in Syria. So anyhow, when we have problems and we need to send someone in, we send Smiley Joe.
Oh, wow. Uncle Joe.
Joe goes to Ukraine. He goes to Israel. He goes to Turkey the other day. And Erdogan slams the U.S. on Syria again just a few days after Biden visited. He said on the 26th that it gets impertinence, recklessness, and endless demand coming from 12,000 kilometers away. In other words, the United States. His latest not-so-veiled rebuke of U.S. policy towards Syria. Erdogan's outburst came 4 days after the U.S. president left Turkey. This is a lack of respect. And we are losing respect so quickly. And as former Vice President Cheney said, I shared this with you last year, is our enemies don't fear us and our allies don't trust us in the Middle East. And this is certainly complicating situations as we watch the area unraveled. Today, Putin said Moscow to drop gas pipeline to Europe. And they're going to, and he woos Erdogan. I mean, he's really, isn't this interesting? This Gog Magog force of Ezekiel 38 and 39 is coming together. The level of cooperation between Russia and Turkey is improving dramatically. And scrap a $20 billion natural gas pipeline to the European Union, which they desperately need, in favor of a link to Turkey, bolstering economic ties with a contentious Western ally and an EU opposition to a project that was aimed to strengthen the Kremlin's influence in Southeastern Europe. The emergence of Turkey as a major economic partner for Moscow sets aside their conflicting military and political agendas, especially in Syria. This is very significant. And that oil, that natural gas, the 30 to 35% that Europe so desperately needs, the pipeline is going to go down to Turkey. And Turkey and Russia is going to be responsible for getting that natural gas back up to Europe. But this is a byproduct of the boycotting that's been taking place because of what's happening in the Ukraine with Russia and the West and the United States' boycotts of Russian products and other goods. We have seen in the last couple weeks a continued building of EU and UN pressure on Israel. I had the opportunity to be at, there's two locations that the European Parliament operate out of, Brussels, Belgium, and Strasbourg, France. And had the opportunity on November 20th and 21st to be at the Parliament Chambers at the EU Parliament in Brussels. Claudia and I went there, and it was an excellent event. We spent 2 days there meeting with mostly European Christians that are supporting and standing for Israel. They're lobbying throughout Europe on Israel's behalf. And this is Thomas Sandell there in the middle. The guy in the middle is a Coptic Christian from Egypt who had been beaten by Muslims in Egypt. He shared his testimony, and the man to his right is a Israeli official that represents Israel at the EU Parliament. It was a fantastic presentation. And here I am with Thomas Sandell. And it was interesting. I told Thomas, I said, "You really have a tough job." In the United States, we have AIPAC. That's an enormous Israeli, American Israel Policy Affairs Committee that has done an extraordinary job of getting U.S. Congress, the Senate and the House, to support Israel. And I would say if there was a vote today, 90 to 95% of Congress would vote with Israel. Easily. It is a remarkable job that they've done. Plus, we have some large organizations. Christians United for Israel, even though we do not appreciate the fact that they keep Jewish believers from being part of that organization. And the fact that a lot of their money, most of their money, goes to Jewish groups, Orthodox groups, and not Messianic believers in Israel. But nonetheless, they have been effective in lobbying on Capitol Hill, and they supposedly have about 1.6 million people on their list right now. But there are so many supportive groups. This group here and many other groups are so supportive of Israel that America overwhelmingly supports Israel, no matter what. But in Europe, you have the World Council of Churches in Geneva. You have the UN Human Rights Committee that blasts Israel every chance they get, that they're headquartered in Geneva. You have the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Group out of the UK. And there's many other groups spread throughout Europe that are not pro-Israel. And I, at one of the dinners on that Thursday night, I had an opportunity to speak to a guy that's involved in evangelism throughout Europe. They have young people throughout Europe evangelizing in country after country. And I said, "David, what is the born-again population? What would you estimate in Europe right now, in the European Union? What percent born-again believers are there in Europe?" He said 1.5%. And I spoke to a friend here today from the UK, and he said 1.5% is probably generous. Can you believe that? 1.5% of Europe? Born-again believers? And then if you spend time there, like our other brothers, Paul and others that live in the UK, you can see why they are so unsupportive of Israel. And you can see why it's so difficult for Christians to stand for Israel. I mean, European Coalition for Israel, you imagine the work that they have to do or attempt to do in the EU With that kind of population, it's amazing, and it's hard for us to comprehend because we still have a lot more than 1.5% in the United States. And we're also very, very proactive. The EU vote, this is the Washington Post today, and the previous vote on the PA, those who favor a Palestinian state are in the green. Those in the yellow have abstained, and the one down in the bottom, I'm not sure, I can't read that quite well enough, but anyhow,
Austria,
yeah. Which has become a Islamic headquarters, and a lot of the Muslims are coming out of the Balkans into Austria. And today, I just might throw this in Vienna today, that there's more Muslims in the school system in Vienna, Austria, than any other race. So, anyhow, this is Europe is so quickly going in this direction to favor a Palestinian state. Growing divide with Israel in Europe. This is from Barak Ravid. He's with Hobbits. I know Barak, pretty decent guy. Leftist, but he's a sharp guy. And he is prone to spoofs. This was in the Washington Post today. He wrote that the UK and France are considering recalling their ambassadors to Israel.
Wow.
This is not good news. Prime Minister Netanyahu had just approved construction of thousands of new Israeli settler homes in a sensitive area in the West Bank known as Area E1, which is between Jerusalem and Me'elim Adamim. That area right there, and the European powers have said they've had enough. Ravid quoted a senior European diplomat as saying, this time it won't just be a condemnation, there will be a real action taken against Israel. The French lawmakers today voted or called on their government to recognize a Palestinian state. This is after Sweden. This is after a resolution that was overwhelmingly passed in the UK, overwhelmingly favored a Palestinian state. Spain has already approved a Palestinian state, and this is building up to the big EU Parliament vote here in a couple weeks. And then the EU... Yeah, I mentioned this. This will be the big vote. This new foreign affairs and security policy rep, as soon as she was sworn in, she got on a plane and went to Israel and said, we've had enough war in Gaza. You know, these wars every other year have to stop, and it's time for a Palestinian state. In other words, the EU is tired of helping reconstruct these cities, and it's time for peace. So it's not like a financial reason to say that. So she has she's Italian, she has a leftist background, and she is determined to see, she says, within 5 years of Palestinian state. I mean, she put 5 years on it, but she is very determined to push this vote to the EU Parliament here shortly. And then the Arab League, a couple days ago, have started pushing the UN on the Palestinian state, and we read today that the UN Security Council is going to consider the Palestinians' 1967 border resolution. The UN Security Council has five permanent members. That's France, the UK, the United States, Russia, and China, and 10 rotating members. So the five permanent states have to agree for any kind of resolution for it to be put in place. Today, they can probably get four of the five votes of the UN resolution to agree something like this. We're not there yet. The United States is not favorable towards that yet. But the UK, the French, the Russian, and the Chinese would. So we're one vote away from the Security Council asking for Israel to go back to the six-day borders. The United States is keeping that from happening. And then the Shia versus Sunni conflict. This continues to build in the Middle East, and this could be the one of the stories of 2015, is this increasing challenge between the Shiites and Sunnis. A quick overview, I'm going to go through these fairly quick, is Iranians are very strategic and they're very patient. A journalist from Iraq told me that he says that Arabs tend to be one-dimensional thinkers, and Iranians are very bright three-dimensional thinkers. And when you watch Iran's negotiations with the P5+1 over Iran's weapon program, you can see how clever and crafty the Iranians are. They're masters of negotiation. And they are going to negotiate until they finish their nuclear weapon. I think almost everybody here in this room realizes that, except for the representatives of the P5+1. Permanent members of the Security Council and Germany. Iran's missile technology has improved dramatically over the last couple years. According to Uzi Rubin, the father of the Arrow Missile Defense Program, said his great concern was the fact that Iran had made substantial gains in their short-range missile capability. In other words, every Sunni country that borders the Persian Gulf that supplies 25% to 30% of the daily oil and is in rocket and missile range of very advanced Iranian missiles and rockets. This is a very significant problem. In some ways, Israel is a smokescreen where their ultimate plan is to control the oil in the Mediterranean. And the caliphate plan that we all know from Iran through Iraq through Syria, Lebanon, Israel. That's their plan, is to control the Middle East as well as Afghanistan. The ISIS threat. I'll go into that in just a bit. And then the Israel statements. They continue to say scathing comments about Israel. And then Russia and China have both had military maneuvers separately with Iran this year in the Persian Gulf. What does that say to the international community? China having military maneuvers with Iran in the Persian Gulf. And China gets a lot of their oil and natural gas from Iran. And here's the ballistic missiles. Israel's in range. The Sunni countries are in range. And they're working on ICBM now that will put Western Europe and the United States at risk. And they also have sites. Iran would love to deploy missiles in Venezuela and to point them at the United States with electromagnetic pulse capability, as well as having the capability to fire missiles off container ships off our east or west coast, which would put our power grid at risk. We have had former CIA members, we've had former congressmen and senators for the last 6 years since Obama took office that said the United States needs to reinforce the power grid. We have four major grids, and Texas has its own, so there's five grids. It cost between $5 and $7 billion, and the money was not allocated to reinforce our power grid. We are extremely vulnerable right now to electromagnetic pulse attack, which would knock us back into the early 1900s. Mark Langton, a Jewish friend of mine from New York, he's a real estate attorney in New York City, put this map together. And I think Mark really has put some great detail here. About 50, at this point, a little less than 50% of the world's oil reserves are in this black gold triangle. And that's really what Iran would like to control. Can you imagine what kind of havoc they would control, or they would be able to produce to the economies of the world if they controlled the oil through the Persian Gulf? It would crush the world economies instantaneously. But we have been blessed in this country that none of this has happened to this point. But that's a very significant... That's their goal. That's their goal as much as anything else, is to control. The caliphate's second, but this is to control the oil and natural gas in the Middle East. Another challenge the United States has right now is Afghanistan. The Taliban... The assistant, I think it was the assistant police chief of Kabul the other day quit, and I think the police chief is about to quit. The Taliban are increasing their terror activities throughout Afghanistan, and we and NATO are supposed to have all our troops out of there. by the end of this year. The United States has spent a fortune. We spent $25 billion training 65,000 Iraqi troops. Hasn't been a great investment. And we have trained, I think it's just over 200,000 Afghanis. Well, first of all, we had to teach them how to write and read. Read and then write. They couldn't even do that. So a lot of our assets went into reading, writing, and then learning how to use their equipment. And it's a real serious situation. This Afghanistan could get out of control. And it's already starting to happen right now. It's almost like the Taliban is chasing us out of town. And this is an area of great concern. And then ISIS. They have the CIA and some other intelligence services that we had said that this was going to, that they were going to do something like this. No one believed that they would be able to obtain so much land so quick. But they did, and they were able to accomplish it. Despite, there were warnings to the Obama White House that you need to watch this, because and also the Defense Department. This is going to get out of control. And they didn't do anything, and now we have a major, major, major issue here. I won't go into a lot of details. Tom, get some water. Can I get a water there? I didn't want to wake you there.
Sure.
Been a long day, I know.
Well, you're better off when I'm asleep.
Great point. I'm better off when he's asleep. I agree. You're the best. Saudi Arabia, great concern about the future of Saudi Arabia. Who is going to be the leader of Saudi Arabia? This is a succession problem. And, you know, right now the Saudis are going to try to break our shale activity here in the United States. They're going to keep dropping the price. And one of our friends here today mentioned the fact that this also has to do with depleting Iran of more and more capital. So they're going to try to put the squeeze on the shale development in North Dakota and also Iran. I mean, excuse me, North Dakota and also Texas, but at the same time also inflict some harm on Iran because Iran needs $120 to $150 oil. Russia needs that kind of price. Algeria, Nigeria, Venezuela. These low oil prices are killing these countries. And that could be a concern, too. Russia and Iran need high-priced oil, as well as other countries. But Saudi Arabia has almost $1 trillion in foreign reserves. Kuwait, $750 billion. They have a tremendous amount of money. So Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and the Kuwait are behind putting the squeeze on the price of oil to try to, because they're worried about losing more market control. So, but the big concern is these oil refineries. Majority of Saudi's oil is in the northeast portion of the country. And Iran's told people if we are attacked, we will attack those refinery areas. So this is not new news. Erdogan's vision is to be a leader of the Middle East. This is his heart. This is his goal. He's got Islamists in control of his country. He's getting more and more radical. He's saying women are not equal. Christopher Columbus was second to the U.S., and it goes on and on. He was behind the flotilla incident. His relations with Russia and China are good, and his relations with Obama have been a little bit testier in the last year or so, but again, that was Obama's best friend for quite a few years in the Middle East. Syria continues to be a significant problem. 200,000 killed, a major crisis, Christian persecution. You've got a battlefield. Islamic State is in the northern end of Syria, and they are battling for the future of Syria. And, we can look at Isaiah 17:1, the day that Damascus will no longer exist as a city. So most of you are familiar with what's been taking place in Syria, and unfortunately, Syria and Iraq have really become the battlefield of the most radical members of Islam. This is their play field. This is their playing ground, for the lack of a better thing. Islamic State is able to bring people together. Their comments, their brutality, their commitment, the fact they have $2 or $3 billion in the bank, the fact that they have a tremendous amount of income from oil. The fact that they have very advanced weapons that they were able to get in Iraq, a lot of them are American weapons, they are very formidable terror group, and they have been able to recruit some of the most brutal Muslim thugs from around the Middle East to fight their cause. Jordan, a lot of concern about ISIS eyes in Jordan. And I can tell you right now, Israel and the United States are doing a lot. They are working closely with Jordan to keep them up to date. If Jordan gets attacked by ISIS, Israel could go in. The United States could go in. But Israel knows they cannot afford to lose that border to ISIS. And so if ISIS is unwise in attempts to take over Jordan, you're going to see Israel and you're going to see the United States probably do everything they can. King Abdullah will be at the White House this week because of the ISIS threat that he continues to be concerned about. And then Jordan, again, is a refugee crisis. It was Iraqis and now it's Assyrians. It's unbelievable how many people they've had to absorb during these last the conflict in Iraq and the conflict in Syria. Lebanon, Hezbollah, now, according to the IDF spokesperson, Peter Lerner, who is responsible for media relations with international news organizations, says Hezbollah now has 100,000 missiles and rockets and literally can hit any area of Israel. Just think, we had UN peacekeepers in there that were supposed to stop this since the 2006 conflict. What has happened? They have twice what they had in 2006 under the nose of the UN peacekeepers. And then obviously Iran looks at Hezbollah as their front. In many ways they believe that's their insurance policy and why Israel will not attack Iran because the missiles and rockets will start firing, will start coming down on Israel as soon as Iran is hit. But anyhow, Israel's preparing for the next war with Hezbollah, and the next war will be very significant. According to some of the generals in Israel, there will be areas of southern Lebanon that will not be inhabitable for 10 years. They know that the next war with Hezbollah, they've got to finish the problem. Egypt, continued challenge there. Fortunately, El-Sisi's been able to take over the country. And he's working well with Israel. He shut the border to Hamas. He stopped the weapons trades, the illegal trade. But it's a country that's got a big problem. $200 billion gross domestic product in a country of 84 million, where Israel has 8 million people, and their gross domestic product is $300 billion. $300 billion versus $200 billion and 84 million people. Pope Francis has become, there was mention today about Pope Francis and some of his objectives. Pope Francis has spoken to the world of a two-state plan. He has spoken about reaching out to Islam, and he's doing it. And he's also equated Allah to God, as if Allah is the same God as the God of the Jews and Christians. This has been in the Vatican has been like that for a long time. They have had the way they speak of Allah as if it is the same God that we worship. Pope Francis, I'm going to cover a couple areas. He was in Amman, Bethlehem, and Jerusalem earlier this year. He was at the Vatican with Perez and Abbas. He is going after a Christian unity event. He's already started out with Ken Copeland, James Robeson from this area, and Tunnicliffe, who's the head of one of the large evangelical alliances. And then the Islam outreach, praying in a mosque. So, anyhow, May 24th and 26th, the Pope started his pilgrimage to Jordan and in Israel by starting in Jordan first. Rather than starting in Israel and then going to meet with the Palestinians and then going to the Jordanians, he did it in reverse. The Pope publicly called for a state of Palestine, an Arab state that would exist in the biblical heartland of Judea and Samaria. He stated that in Amman, he stated that in Bethlehem, and he stated that in Jerusalem. He told the world the billion Catholics who ever watched this, he told the Arab world about two states in the biblical heartland of Judea and Samaria. The Pope in Bethlehem. You'll notice here is you've got baby Jesus in a kippah. The Arabs made sure that he looked, that people saw baby Jesus as if he was an Arab, or as if he was a Palestinian. And then you can see the fellow right above that in the Arab dress. This is right as the Pope is giving a mass in Bethlehem. And then right after that, the Pope had, this was the day after this, the Pope and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem had a meeting on top of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem with the Dome of the Rock behind it for the world to see the Pope. And then right after the Mass at Bethlehem, the Pope was convinced by some of the Palestinians to go to the separation wall, and this became a very contentious issue. And the next day, the Pope made sure everybody saw him go to Mount Herzl to honor fallen Israel soldiers. But this is what the world saw. The Catholics and the Arabs around the world saw the Pope in front of the Free Palestine sign. It's one of the security walls. Then the Pope wanted to meet with Peres and Abbas in Jerusalem to have a prayer. But Abbas said, no, I can't come to Jerusalem. I can't get through the security checkpoints. He could have got through. But he wanted the propaganda of being at the Vatican for having Muslim prayer given from the Vatican. And this was on Al Jazeera and every major Muslim paper or newspaper or internet site around the world of Abbas giving a Islamic prayer from the Vatican. And then just a couple days ago, the Pope was with the Grand Mufti of Ankara praying at the Sultan Ahmed Mosque in Istanbul. Every European paper has picked this up. This is big news. This is big news throughout the Middle East. I had three friends. I had one friend and a couple of his friends, I should put it that way, meet with Father Bergoglio before he became the Pope. They had a meeting in Buenos Aires. They met for about an hour. My friend, who's a Jewish believer, both his parents were in the Holocaust. The father, who's a very decent man, and I think this is working to his disadvantage, obviously, believes that the Jews are chosen, the chosen people. He understands the covenants. He understands the importance of the Jewish people. One of the Pope's close friends of Buenos Aires was the chief rabbi of Buenos Aires. And they had a wonderful meeting, and he believes, he spoke of the Abrahamic covenant. And he doesn't appear to be anti-Semitic. My friend is extremely discerning. And he talked about the travesty of the Holocaust with my friend. And then they had a prayer with the Pope, and a couple weeks later, he's the new Pope. Very interesting, to say the least. But this Pope has become more and more controversial. And, we'll let history we'll let events decide the true history of what's coming. But nonetheless, you can see how he's being used by the enemy. And then the Pope, along with a bishop named Tony Palmer, started promoting unity between the Catholics and the Protestants, evangelicals. And Tony Palmer, the bishop, this Anglican bishop, said that the Protestant era is over and it's time for the Protestants and Catholics to unify. And he says this spiritual apartheid must end. Tony Palmer was on the board of Ken Copeland's ministry and also developed a friendship with Father Bergoglio when he was the Vatican representative in Argentina as a father, and I believe he was a cardinal as well, but a father, Father Bergoglio. So He helped orchestrate this meeting. First of all, he got the Pope on an iPhone to give a message to Ken Copeland's ministry event in Fort Worth. I know there was a lot of people in that audience, I understand, that were uncomfortable with this unity message. But anyhow, Palmer was able to facilitate the Pope giving a message to the conference. And it led to this event. This was on June 24th of this year, when you have Ken Copeland, James Robeson, Tunnicliffe, John Arnott from the Toronto situation there, Toronto Blessing, whatever you want to call it. But anyhow, this was orchestrated at the Vatican, and Copeland was ecstatic. James Robeson was ecstatic that we're going to unify with the Catholic Church. But, you know, this is serious.
Absolutely.
This is extremely serious. I think some of these guys believe that one day that the Catholic Church is just going to get everything right, and they're going to fall right into place, and they're going to repent for their teachings and their ways, and everything is going to work out just fine. But this is dangerous. But this is final day apostasy. This is final day blasphemy. And this is leading to the final day events and the final day deception, whether it's with unifying the church or whether it has to do with the Catholics and the Muslims and Catholic and Islam coming together in unity. But this is happening, and it's happening at an amazingly quick pace. This was on June 24th. And on 3 weeks later, Tony Palmer was killed in a head-on motorcycle accident. He was driving his motorcycle, and a car crossed the center line and hit him. And they spent about 10 hours trying to revive him, but he died. Very unusual, 3 weeks after this event took place at the Vatican. And I'll finish with this. Prime Minister Netanyahu has probably got the toughest job in politics. He's got a very, very tough job. And in Israel, it's parliament. And our government isn't perfect. It isn't. But there's a lot of things about our government that's much, much better than a parliamentary government. And in Israel, in order to legislate, you have to develop these coalitions in order to have 61 members of your coalition out of 120 members in the Knesset. Well, this coalition that he's had has been a difficult one with Libni, with Bennett, or Bennett to a certain extent, Lapid. And today, Benjamin Netanyahu called for early elections. He fired Lapid. He's off his cabinet. Libni's off his cabinet. All of Lapid's other associates that were on the cabinet have quit. So Israel is going to an election in the spring. The government is collapsing. Prime Minister Netanyahu can attempt to form a coalition with the Shas party, which are the Orthodox Jews, that make it really difficult on Jewish believers in Israel. Very difficult for all the Jewish believers that we have that live in Israel and those from the U.S. that try to get into Israel as citizens. This is not good. The Shas party is not good. They're Orthodox Jews who have very effectively been able to legally extort a tremendous amount of money for their education. They don't serve, most of them don't serve in the military, on and on and on. But right now, Libni and Lapid and others were saying that Netanyahu was trying to cut a deal with the Shas party, and I think it's United Judaism or United something of that
United
nature.
United Toward Judaism.
Thank you. Yeah, that was very helpful.
Thank you. Good shot.
We work well together. United Toward
Judaism.
Yeah, that's United Toward Judaism. That's the other ultra-Orthodox party. So that's the talk. If Netanyahu can form a coalition during this non-confidence time, there won't be an election. But it's moving toward election. There'll be one in the spring. And look at the pressure he's getting from the EU, from the United States, and now within his own country. It looks like, based on the polls, Israel wants Netanyahu to be their leader during tough times. They have a lot of faith in his strength and his decision making during difficult times. And there's a high probability that he will become the prime minister again based on the polls. Things can change. But nonetheless, this is where we're heading. The Hamas war, the Sunni versus Shiites, the border concerns, the security concerns, and the time to eliminate the threat, which is Hezbollah. These are things Prime Minister Netanyahu also has to deal with. And that's pretty much the same thing. And then, on a good note, the U.S. weapon, the Iron Dome, was funded by the United States. And we've been blessed for that. And the technology came from Israel, but we funded an amazing weapon. Just think of how many Israelis would have lost their life if that Iron Dome had not been in place after all those thousands upon thousands of rockets were fired at Israel. And there also, and I'll finish with these couple things, there's also an assumption that the U.S., the weapons that Israel receives from the United States, that Israel receives, are not capable of dealing with the Iranian threat. And as Yoram Edinger said last year, we receive those weapons and we improve every one of them dramatically. Israel has a plan to deal with the Iranian threat. It's well thought out and it will be decisive if and when they have to do it. In Jeremiah 49, Bill Salas' work, Jeremiah 49, 35 through 39, speaks to the time that Elam will be devastated, that this area will be devastated to the extent that, and when you read the scriptures, it looks like Israel's going to be the one. At some point, Israel is going to have to deal with the Iranian threat, and I think that's the fulfillment of Jeremiah 49 through 35. 49, 35 through 39. And no one else seems to have the appetite, especially the United States. So Israel knows at some point they cannot put their nation at risk. They're going to have to deal with that threat. And then F-16s, over 500 suggested improvements Israel gave to us when we gave them the F-16s. The bunker-busting bombs are much more effective after Israel put their hands on them. And we have satellites to help with missiles and rockets. And also the two nuclear subs that Israel has in the Persian Gulf are the type of equipment that Israel needs to defend themselves. So, in other words, Israel has the resources. They don't want to go to war. They'd love to have the United States to be there, but we know this is a tough neighborhood, and we also know the final day prophecies are being fulfilled right before our eyes, and only the God of Israel knows the timing of how this is all going to play out. So, thank you.
Thank you. Goodness, scared myself. Wilfred Hahn is going to come and give us more current events. Eh?